When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection, to the opening arguments, to the witness testimony and cross-examination, and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for November 30th, 2017, the pass-through edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. John Dickerson joins me in the DC studio. Howdy, John Dickerson of Face the Nation.
Howdy.
And you're back. Where were you last week? Both of you and Emily were gone.
I was away.
John was officiating at a wedding, weren't you? Or maybe you don't want to talk about that.
Too late.
Yes, I was officiating a wedding. No, I don't mind talking about it. Yes.
I just thought that was such a lovely idea.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was actually a great, among other things, the wonder and joy of the wedding was it's a heck of a writing assignment to have to sit down and like be intentional about marriage and the ceremony and what marriage is about and all of that. So it was a nice, and what better time to do that than now?
Hmm. That, of course, that other voice not officiating a wedding ceremony, although she'd be great. And also with her legal degree, she probably is entitled to do it. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine.
I am not entitled to officiate at anyone's wedding without one of those Insta licenses.
But you passed the bar.
Yeah, I don't think that entitles you.
All right. On this week's GabFest, the Republican tax bill is marching relentlessly toward passage. Is it just as bad as it seems, or is it worse than it seems? Those are the two choices. Then an attempt to embarrass the Washington Post backfires. Is James O'Keefe and his Project Veritas dangerous or just absurd. Then the most important digital privacy case perhaps ever arrives at the Supreme Court. Emily will break it down for us. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. And remember, Bostonians and those near Boston, we have a political GabFest conundrum show live next week at the Wilbur Theater. There are just a few tickets left. Oh, my God.
Worth only a little whimper. The sound
effect. The closer we get, I don't know. I was trying to, like so many people in Washington right now, I was trying to come up with a post hoc justification for that lame behavior, and I could not come up with one.
In any case, we have a GabFest Live at the Wilbur Theater on Wednesday, December 6th, and tickets are at slate.com/live, and of course, They Might Be Giants are going to be joining us for that show. It is going to be super duper fun, so if you have a chance to make it, please come. There's a couple, some just great conundrums that have been sent. So here's one which I'm looking forward to. Which fictional character would you most want to be friends with if he or she were plopped into real life 2017? That's a conundrum we could discuss.
That's great.
I love that.
Yeah, yes. I like that one too.
So slate.com/live for tickets. Hope to see you there next week. The tax bill is well on its way to becoming law, having cleared Senate committee on a party line vote. The Senate version of the bill is rolling on freshly laid asphalt toward passage. A couple of senators will be bought off with tweaks to help pass-through businesses. And the owners of pass-through businesses get a better deal. A couple of others will be bought off with some mumbled promises about health care. There'll be a couple of others bought off with some preposterous chicanery with tax triggers around deficit worries. Lisa Murkowski will be bought off with a promise to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling. Everyone is going to end up voting for this. So, Emily, first of all, have you turned yourself into a pass-through business?
I probably will. It seems like it will be in my interest to do so. Mm-hmm. But no, I have not already done so. But I think the question notes the chicanery of this bill, which creates all kinds of work for tax lawyers and new dodges and feints, which is, of course, the opposite of what tax reform should do, along with, and to me, this is the central part of it, just this breathtaking move toward increasing inequality in the United States, which I just find to be unfathomable. I don't understand why we are letting this happen.
John, well, first of all, just on the politics. Is there anything that you see at this moment that endangers passage of this bill?
No, I don't think so. I think the people will get what they need and it'll get tweaked. And given the gimmicks and spin that's already been allowed and that everybody's already signed up for, including those who have problems with the bill, they've already bought into a lot of things that are verifiably either not true or a lot less certain than they've said they are. And that's, you do that in legislation. They can just go a little further down the road by professing to believe in something that they'll get there.
Right. If you already believe 2 + 2 = 5, then you can believe 2 + 2 = 6.
That's right. They've taken this to a new level here, particularly because if you look just on the issue of the debt and deficit, this is the Republican Party that's passing this has spent the last many, 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 many years when they talk about these issues, the central point is that they don't want to add overwhelmingly to the debt and deficit because they think it will slow economic growth. And they are basically ignoring all of that they have said before.
Emily, this bill began as a promise of tax reform. Is this tax reform?
It's tax change. It rearranges the winners and losers from the tax code. But if you think of tax reform as being about simplifying, then no, it's not.
By the standards that they set for this bill when it came out, that it fails. So it was supposed to simplify. It's not going to simplify. It's going to make things much more complicated. It's going to make the IRS bigger because, and I think this makes sense to me as it was explained, the only way you can get the revenue that you need, because it's not going to come from the growth as much as the as that they're promising that it will. The way you need to get the revenue is if the IRS is watching whether people are following the rules here, which means you're going to need more people at the IRS, which is an institution that conservatives want to get, you know, shrink or get rid of. So, and that great tax reform would get rid of, but this isn't reform in that sense. And as a middle class tax cut, it's not that either because of the sunset provisions in the Senate and also on balance, where when you look at the energy of the plan, one thing that has never been in doubt is that the corporate tax rate is going to get cut significantly. What has been very much in doubt and has shifted over the course of selling this bill is that the middle class, that everybody in the middle class will get a tax cut. That's the thing that's fuzzy and movable. It's kind of a two-pieced middle-class tax cut. There's the direct money you'll get from when you fill out your form, but then there's this secondary benefit that the proponents argue will come from jobs and investment and increase in wages, which if it comes, and we should discuss that idea and the opposition to it, it's not going to come for quite a while, whereas the corporate tax cut will start paying dividends right away. As it were.
So basically one of the problems I have with this whole segment is that I am so angry. And so in order for me to get to a reasonable conversation, I just now need to express my anger. So I'm just going to do
ahead.
That. Okay. This bill is an abomination. It is a curse on the country. It is a stupid, destructive piece of legislation to massively benefit the rich, to weaken the economy in the long term, to punish blue states in a vindictive way that will hurt teachers, graduate students, parents, kids, the poor. It is exactly the opposite of what Trump promised. It's exactly the opposite of what the populists, the Bannons of the world said they wanted to do. It's a monstrous giveaway to the rich who get estate tax breaks that they don't deserve, shouldn't have, because estate tax should be high. These breaks for pass-through corporations that will benefit, again, the very rich mostly. Huge payoffs from lower corporate taxes, which will not go to investment, but will instead line the pockets of who? Yeah, the rich, the people who own shares and companies that will benefit from that. Every possible reward is going to the rich. 62% of the benefits of this bill go to the top 1% of the country. 62% of it. You have actual harm to households making less than $75,000. It is deficit financed so that we are basically giving the spinach to the future. It's a tax on our children. And it is taking money out of the economy at a prosperous time, at a time when we should lower the deficit. We're raising the deficit, leaving us less room for stimulus, less room to grow an economy if we run into trouble later in the future, because we will have driven up our deficit and driven up interest rates, making it harder for us to rebound from a future recession. It's going to force up healthcare premiums. It's going to take 13 million people off of health insurance. So we're giving this massive gift to rich people who have already harvested the lion's share of economic growth over the past 20 years for no benefit to the country. The country that will have to forcibly be forced to cut government benefits to people who need it and who will bear the brunt of this in the future. It is, you know, as John pointed out, it violates the very principles that Republicans have been preaching for generations about controlling the deficit. And it doesn't fucking have to be this way. It's perfectly possible to convene a panel of economists or panel of politicians who can come up with a cut to the corporate tax rate and a middle-class tax cut that doesn't do this. And they chose not to. And it's among the most depressing and dishonest pieces of work I've seen in Washington. And I've seen a lot of shit in Washington over the past couple of years. This is even worse than the fucking healthcare bills. I'm just depressed and angry and really enraged about it. There we go.
Let me just...
So I'm done now.
On the final point about there could have been another way. So the Business Roundtable and like one other, I can't remember, pro business group basically said, take us down to 25%. So the 20% number comes from President Trump. It's not based on any magical thing, but it has taken on a magical proportion. There's some discussion this week about increasing it in the Senate, mostly to try to get a tiny bit of money to make the child tax credit refundable or do other things that might slightly increase the benefit on the middle class level. What's one thing that strikes me as really extraordinary is part of the power of the president's, or the argument the president puts forward is, look at how great the market is doing. And this bill is, you know, clearly, to the extent that CEOs, Bloomberg had a piece this week in which they interviewed lots of CEOs, and they found basically two classes of CEOs. They found one, the class of CEOs who thought this was a moral aberration because it exacerbates the problems of income income inequality. And then they found other CEOs who said, we're going to take our money and basically buy back shares and increase dividends, not put it into immediate wage hikes and development. Now, there are some companies, AT&T and others, who've promised to make investments, and it's clear investments over time will take place corporate tax break. The question is, how long does that take? And does it then accrue to the benefit of people in the middle class? You have to work for one of those companies. Those companies have to choose to hire people instead of putting in machines. If you look at the Carrier example, candidate Trump put a lot of pressure on the company to keep jobs in America. Those jobs have not materialized in the way he said they would. So the promise of this economic rollout that's going to help the middle class is under some considerable debate. The bill could have been formulated in a different way.
So, I mean, all of that, I sign on to all of that. I also feel like this has been such a discouraging week, month. I can't even figure out the time period, in the sense that all of this is happening in Washington, where it's clear that this is being driven by fear of donors, fear of Republican donors, fear of the kind of performance of needing a win. I mean, we really are in an episode of Veep in that sense, and against the backdrop of President Trump behaving in an unhinged way. You know, he's like tweeting crazy lying videos that are prejudiced against Muslims. I mean, who can even like, he's been attacking the press. Just this stuff, this like lying, fake, destructive, tearing away at, you know, basic norms of our democracy. And none of that is going to matter, even to the supposed, you know, grown-ups like Corker and Flake and McCain. I expect them all to just line up and vote for this bill. And it just makes me really fearful, honestly, for what's going to happen next. Because, look, you can undo a bill, but you can't. What, all of the things that they're allowing in the name of getting this win, what they're standing for, it's very hard to undo the message that is sending about, you know, what America is, what our values are. Like, if I just, people abroad just must be aghast.
But actually, Emily, I agree with the people abroad being aghast, and I don't even think your point that you can undo it is right. That because of also the way that the taxes have become a one-way ratchet for the Republican Party, it's not as if you pull the corporate tax rate down to 20% that a fiscally sound bipartisan
majority
is going to then get it back up to 26%. That's never going to happen. Republicans will never vote for a tax hike that will raise that rate to 25%. It's stuck at 20. I mean, maybe it'll go lower. So if you want to get more revenue, you're going to have to find it from some other means that Republicans are not going to be ever going to endorse. And the way the legislature is structured, I don't see majority Democratic veto-proof majority or filibuster-proof majority for both houses of Congress with a president coming anytime soon. I mean, I wish there would.
I agree. And yet, like, as we welcome with open arms another version of the Gilded Age, all these people who feel so screwed over across the country who voted for Trump, like, how much do they put up with? Like, when you're getting the tiny breadcrumbs on the table left from, like, the big meal that the rich people just ate, like, it just doesn't seem
Can I ask you, this is a question, John, which you're going to answer, which is the tax bill polls as being unpopular, but is it actually unpopular?
First of all, it's quite unpopular. The tax bill, it's quite popular in Republican ranks. And we've basically moved to a base-only presidency and a base-only system of government. So within the Republican ranks, it's quite popular. The president's very popular. The only people who aren't popular are Republican leaders. So this will help them with their base, and that's what matters now. In terms of the Trump base, the Trump supporters that I've talked to have two views. One, they believe in the underlying argument of the president and the people who put forward this bill, which is, A, the market is going up, so that's good. The economy is healthy, which we should note is an extraordinary shift from what happened during the campaign. I mean, the president demonized Goldman Sachs, demonized Wall Street. Wall Street is now the thing he and his supporters use as, well, he particularly use as the sign that he's doing right by the country. So that's
basically as if the stock market is the economy.
Right.
Sorry,
exactly. And that's after running a campaign in which Goldman Sachs and Lloyd Blankfein, the chairman of Goldman Sachs, were used as the boogeyman. So that's just kind of an extraordinary pass and thing to But basically, people, there is a booster rooting, interest in this, which is basically they want their guy to win, and any win is a win. Those in the upper income or those in the kind of the suburban Republican voter may very well see share prices increase and, may benefit from this in ways that will make it popular. They'll be happier. The people who might not benefit directly, nevertheless, like it because it's a win for their team. And so I think you could imagine, I'm not saying that's the way it will work out, but you could imagine it becoming a lot more popular once it passes.
Plus, you could also imagine the consequences coming to pass, because they will, in a way that does not clearly lead to rejection.
Right.
It'll be down the line. Right. It'll be someone else picking up the garbage. Yep. It'll probably be the Democrats shoveling out the shit. And that also just like, oh, man, it's just like, it really feels to me like we are in decline. I mean, we've had other moments of that, but this legislation feels like such a scam on a different level.
Go ahead.
One of the key points of the president's campaign was that the swamp was occupied by two kinds of people, special interests and big money donors who treated the members of Congress like puppets. In all of the conversation about how this has to be passed because donors want it, it's an affirmation of that puppet-puppeteer relationship that the president said was so awful and that he was going to change in Washington. So just in terms of the ways in which you can argue about the actual policy of this, but in terms of the ways in which this runs counter to what people were being told and being promised, that would be another thing I'd put in that category.
And yet they're not like rising up in protest, right? If Trump's right, that's the part of it that I just
who's
find,
not rising
like,
up in protest? The voters who wanted the swamp drained.
The populists, like, this is not conservative populism, this bill. Like, where is that sense of like, wait, we're not getting what we were promised and we're going to hold you accountable? When Trump says black is white and white is black, I feel like we're turning into a country of sheep.
Well, it's that I think that so much of what conservatism is, or Trumpianism is just trying to own liberals. It's like getting a win and owning liberals, and so it doesn't really matter how you get it. It's that they're not, and so Trump's going to get a win, and so that's more important than whatever substance is actually behind
it. And I would separate that from conservatives, because there are a stratification here of those who think this is bad conservative economic policy, and then others who think it's mediocre policy, but better than, they want to see corporate tax cuts for defensible economics.
John, let's...
And it is defensible. Corporate tax cuts are defensible. Let's just, make that clear. It's this level at the cost of everything else. Okay.
And for the trade-offs.
The estate tax shit just makes me...
Is not defensible.
That is just absolutely undefensible. It is so wrong. But let's talk for a second, John, about everything else that is piling up. Because in addition to this tax bill, we have debt ceiling crisis approaching. We have the children's health care plan that needs to be renewed, the Earth and Iran sanctions that the Senate needs to consider. There's DACA. There's supposed to be a sort of a DACA fix that's supposed to be considered. And we had Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi pulling out of a meeting with the president this week after the president tweeted that there was no deal to be done with Democrats. This tax bill can pass just – and also the PAYGO effects of this tax bill, which means that under PAYGO you're going to have to take – significant amount out of Medicare next year if you want to abide by the PAYGO rules, which would happen automatically. So is this bill can pass under reconciliation with 50 votes in the Senate. None of the other stuff can. What does the rest of the legislative landscape look like?
It looks pretty bleak. I mean, I think the debt ceiling can be put off until next year through quote unquote extraordinary measures. So you might get some continuing resolutions. But I don't know. And as far as I think DACA, they can wait till next year.
March 5th.
Yeah, it was tied to government funding because it was a way in which Democrats could use the leverage of keeping the government funded to get what they wanted on DACA. And then on Iran, that is the big question. Secretary Tillerson, who was against pulling out of the deal, has lost even more favor with the president. But it's really, this is all on Congress, and I don't know how they get it done. There's just, They only got, I don't know how many more legislative days they've got in the year, but not many. The tax question is going to take us right up to the deadline. And the deadline for CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance, which covers about 9 million children, has already passed. The deadline's passed.
And states are sending out notices that they're going to be canceling coverage.
They're running out of money. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how it gets. I don't know how it gets handled. Oh, and by the way, we haven't even talked about there's a FISA court renewal that has to take place too, Emily. I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Another thing by the end of the end of the year.
Oh my God! Yep. We have a Slate Plus segment for you, dear listeners, who are Slate Plus members today. That Slate Plus segment is pegged to the royal engagement of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. Does the United States need a royal family? Would we be better off? Would our politics be better if we had a royal family? If you are interested in hearing discussions like that or other Slate Plus segments, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to sign up. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu. Roy Moore is headed for victory in the Alabama special Senate race. He will survive one of the most appalling sex scandals in political history. His creepy, creepy criminal predatory behavior alleged towards teenage girls, including assaults and threats alleged. He will skate because time has passed since his allegations passed, because Alabama really doesn't want to elect a Democrat. Because there have been so many new harassment cases to muddy the waters every day, yet another one, because of Democratic perceived hypocrisy that has given cover to Moore with the unwillingness of Al Franken to step down or of John Conyers to step down.
I'm just going to note that I disagree with the thesis that has a bearing on whether Moore gets elected, even though I don't defend what the Democrats are doing, especially with Conyers.
Oh, I think it gives cover. I think it gives cover.
Whatever. But people I can't imagine that's like what really matters in Alabama. Go ahead.
Anyway, there's one final piece of it, which is came news early this week of a bizarre attempt to discredit the media and discredit the allegations against Moore, an attempt to sting the Washington Post, the paper that had uncovered and reported these allegations against Moore and has done so much incredible journalism over the last year, as has the New York Times, as has many other places, as have many other places. A woman named Jamie Phillips, apparently working for James O'Keefe's Project Veritas, attempted to lure the Post into publishing her made-up story of getting impregnated by Moore at age 15 and then getting an abortion, I think paid for by Moore. The Post saw through her ruse, turned the tables on her, and revealed the scam. It was extremely satisfying, I think, as journalists. We all found that extremely satisfying to see great journalists being careful and reasoning, careful what they're doing and showing how assiduously they work and how honestly they work. In fact, it showed exactly the opposite of what O'Keefe was attempting to show, which is that journalists are fast and loose and have a dishonest bias towards going after conservatives. But Emily, do you want to finish the sentence? Finish the but. I mean, was this pure vindication? I mean, obviously, it's pure vindication for the Post and its reporters and showing what a disgrace O'Keefe is. But, you know, does that mean that now the journalism is free and easy and everyone agrees that the Washington Post is great?
I think not, sadly. Absolutely, the Washington Post like gets many points and roses for the way they handled this. And I had the feeling like I was watching a Spotlight episode as I was reading and watching the videos on this. I should say Spotlight sequel, not episodes. It's a movie, not a television show. But first of all, there is not going to be anything like consensus that the Washington Post triumphed. You know, O'Keefe spins everything as a victory back to like our theme of wins for the sake of wins. I'm sure that his base, which is connected to Trump's base, will celebrate this and somehow cast him as the hero. And the way in which the country is just as polarized and partisan and divided over media as it is over politicians is, you know, new. Not like brand new, not like Fox News just appeared, but this degree of mistrust is a new thing. And there are so many manifestations of it. So one thing I've been noticing, and I wonder if you guys pick this up too. So now when the Post or the Times or NBC or CNN or whatever mainstream media outlet is writing a critical or just like a, you know, scrutinizing story about some part of the government, the spokesperson for the EPA or the FDA or the whoever comes back with, I'm not answering your question because the New York Times or the Washington Post, fill in the blank, is so unfair to us. What you're doing is biased. It's not an engagement with the substance of the critique. It's merely a pillaring of the media outlet. And it seems to be like successful enough that it keeps getting repeated over and over again. I just see James O'Keefe as like an extreme version of that same impulse and phenomenon. And then the second thing about this is like, this is just going to keep happening. And I imagine myself in this situation. Now, I know how to do my job, and I would like to think I wouldn't fall for some false story. And one thing that is kind of crazy is how little cover Jamie Phillips had. Like, once they were on to her, she had really nothing to fall back on. She was clearly not really well prepared or skilled. All of that said, you know, the idea that like every person you talk to could be trying to like undermine your news organization, and you can't just assume that there's like basic goodwill when strangers ask you questions, like, that's bad for all of us to have to be. I am not someone who goes through life suspicious. It's just not my way of being. And I mean, I'm on my guard more than I was before, but I don't think that's good.
Right.
Yeah, I would just like to Stephanie McCrumman, who did the interview. It was great just watching her. It's just watching her, yep, do the interview, because you can't do an interview like that unless you've done hundreds of interviews before, just quietly, patiently doing your work the right way. So that's just a good thing to see, whether it's a reporter or a person, you know, cutting down an old tree. It's a joy to watch somebody do their job well. I think everything you've said is right, Emily. I think you're not as bad as you say, which is to say you are a trusting person. But when it comes to your having talked through many stories with you, your professional instincts about making sure you talk to everyone and treat things the way you're supposed to is actually pretty hardwired.
Wait, I agree. Like, once I know I'm doing my job, I do my job. What scares me is the cat. Like, turns out that Jamie Phillips was going to all these like drinks events with Washington Post reporters and just like hanging out with them. And, you know, other people are, someone's talking to a Washington Post reporter in a bar and trying to get like it. It's that. That's the what I'm talking about.
Although it's
the
funny
idea that you're fair game at any moment.
What this requires, of course, is a misunderstanding and misapprehension of what it is that we do and what it is that we think. So it's very funny to watch Adam Entos, formerly of the Washington Post, saying basically, there might be nothing to this Russia story. Like, we don't know. We're just gathering.
We don't know.
We're looking into it. It might be a total nothing, which is, of course, the case. And yet that's used as some sort of great admission, which misunderstands the idea that you report, and then you might find nothing at the end. But you've got to report it thoroughly in order to affirm that final conclusion. The reporting of it doesn't presuppose that you know what the conclusion is. But they have gone and into this and also frame it as if merely asking the question embeds in it an answer.
One of the things that is so dishonest about O'Keefe posits himself, presents himself as a vindicator of truth, as a person who's ferreting out the bias and proving the bias. And so if you were an actually honest arbiter in that way, you attempt this sting fails utterly. The reporters reveal themselves to be ethical, honest, careful, not out for partisan victory. And then you, if you were an honest person at that moment, you, James O'Keefe, say, here's we thought there was media bias. We attempted to uncover it. It was not revealed to be that so. So we're moving on. And the fact that O'Keefe refuses to do that and instead tries to claim victory and tries to, assert that the Post is corrupt and wrong, just shows how utterly corrupted to the core, how rotten to the core his project is. One of the things that is actually worrisome, though, is that when you look at who's able to do this kind of work that the Post is doing these days. You know, the Post has Jeff Bezos bankrolling them to hundreds. You know, he has $100 billion or whatever it is that he can afford to lose on whatever he wants to lose on. The New York Times, you have a public service minded ownership. But media ownership in general is not like the work that the Post is doing is very expensive and very difficult, not necessarily profitable. Not every entity is going to have people who are as good as the Post and is going to be as ethical as the Post reporters are. And also, not everyone's going to be able to withstand these pressures. So that's pretty worrisome.
Well, and there's sort of two parts of that that are worrisome. There are like the Tronks of the world, these like cookie cutter, cost cutting corporations that come in and gut local newspapers and make them mediocre. And then there's the situation we're in that this essential part of our democracy is at the whim of a small number of very wealthy people who happen to believe in this value. And like, if they're gone, then what happens? I mean, that we're increasingly in that bewildering world in which very, very rich people are driving a lot of important aspects are just like not deeply grounded. And again, it goes back to our first topic and inequality.
What do you guys think is the long-term consequence of the nihilistic approach to media that some folks on the right and even some folks on the left, but mostly on the right, are promoting? This idea that you can never trust the media. The media is always a tool of one partisan institution or another, one partisan group or another. That was a relatively small problem in American life 15 years ago, and it's become an enormous problem.
Well, I think it's always been as virulent. I mean, in terms of just the attitude, it's as virulent on the left as it is on the right. The right has turned it into an operational strategy and has done more with that point of view. But I mean, I guess it just in terms of where it feels like it lives to me just as passionately on the left as the right. What I wonder is what kind of a moment we're really in. I mean, clearly the president cares about his base and about that direct communication message through social media and through certain Fox hosts. You know, presidents in the past at least made some effort to kind of capture the larger part of the country. But since so much of the news is driven by the White House and by this president, we are focused on that narrow casting communication. But the president still has a 37% approval rating. Even if the polls are wildly wrong, the majority of Americans don't approve of what he's doing, and they don't approve of both broad sense, but also specifically. I don't really know where the country is right now. Certainly the people who are most vocal in politics right now, it's completely atomized. I mean, I don't think
that. John, have you had this happen to you? This is something that's happened to me a few times in the last, 6 months, 9 months, where I'll be talking to someone who's not political at all, like doesn't follow news. I have no idea how they vote. And I'll tell them, they'll ask me what I'm working on, and I'll start telling them about a story, and they'll say, oh, that's really interesting. Will you send that to me? Or they'll go find it and they'll come back and want to talk more. And then they'll say, can you send me the other things you're writing? Because I don't know what to trust. But now that I've met you, like, I want to read what you are writing. And I mean, I guess it's a compliment, but I also think it's nuts. The idea that like the fact that you like had a conversation with me somehow means that like I deserve, it's like this,
well,
it's like we're back in like a town square and people are talking to each other personally because they don't know who to trust because, oh, what's coming in over my Facebook feed? I have no idea where any of it's coming from, as opposed to like, here are institutions, and sometimes I'll try to gently say like, well, I work for the New York Times and you could read other things in the New York Times. And I've had people back away from that idea. Like, well, no, I don't know what to trust, like in any particular mainstream media outlet, but I want to read what it's just.
Yeah,
I think it's so not a good sign.
You know, well, it is. I have had that happen. You know, it often happens when people write some rage tweet or horrible email. Like 90% of the times, if you respond, they're like, oh, I didn't realize there was a human there. But like a lot of that rage that people feel or lack of trust that people feel is not the result of the left or the right demonizing us. Like we in the press have done a lot and do it every damn day. I mean, in part, the problem is we are defined by the least among us. So,
No kidding.
So we are defined basically by you're walking through an airport and you see a cable channel running. you know, what is just either an inane conversation or calling out breaking news that has been, you know, something that broke 2 days ago and was really not even breaking news in the first place. And people think, I'm being punked. I'm being tricked.
This is
dishonest. Yes. And the headlines that you read online, you think this is a dishonest business. And so I see how it's super easy to come to the view. And then, by the way, journalism's hard. Sometimes you make mistakes. And so now that everything is framed through this basically operational dishonesty, then natural mistakes, which are the result of the fact that we cover things that are moving pictures, gets fed into that. And so errors of humanity get framed as acts of malice. So
I agree that we are often our own worst enemy, but I don't accept the premise that you can't find incredibly painstaking. I mean,
oh,
right?
My God. Like, yes, every day.
It's a choice. Like, sure. Turn off the television. Sure. I mean, I don't mean to sound like
No. Absolutely right. I mean, that's, again, why I was praising the quiet, work on the Project Veritas video, because that's what goes on all the time. In addition to what what I talked about earlier, I agree with you. We don't want to throw the baby with the bathwater here.
Can I say one other thing, David, in response to your question, like, where does this lead? You know, if the fever breaks, then, like, we go back to being a country in which there is some accepted shared premise of truth. But it's hard to see how that happens now that we're on this road. And this is one area where I find Masha Gessen, like, seeming pretty prescient. And I have disagreements with some of the things she says, but she talks about Putin's disinformation campaign in Russia and the way in which there is no way in Russia to know what's true or not because state propaganda has been so successful at insinuating itself. And I feel like we are moving into that realm, and that means that we are giving away this most important aspect, again, of our democracy, which is like some idea that we can believe what the government is telling us, that we think we know what is true and we have a shared set of facts.
Yeah. And I want to actually add on to that. That was the point I wanted to get to, too, Emily, which is that compounding this sort of partisan disagreement about what media is true and people's distrust of media is the multiplying effect of a government which is now no longer committed or appears to not be committed to honest sharing of information, mm-hmm. of open access to data, of treating data as an important tool, important nonpartisan tool to knowing about the world. And I think we are going to learn one of the incredible greatest strengths of the United States over the past many years, from the development of the census, from the patent office, National Institutes of Standards and Technology, is the creation of monumental amounts of trustworthy data that people could use for business, for trade, for research purposes, for social science purposes. And we are abandoning that. And it's going to be absolutely devastating. We were going to create, first of all, your point, ambiguity, a lack of certainty that people feel, but also just, less knowledgeable, less informed public. And that's catastrophic, because that's our greatest strength, is an informed public.
Although I think the hunger for that information does, I think we have pendulum opportunities here, which is that will happen, what you describe, and then there will be a rush back to expertise.
Maybe. Let's see what shape we're in that rush might be actually looked for.
But this is why I feel like we should basically make everybody take logic for several years in high school as a national. because it
very
would
very popular proposal.
I know, exactly. People are going to rush to this idea, because the more things are argued in social media, and the more people have to hunt for actual who understand how something's being framed in a way, or what good journalism looks like, they will, as you say, Emily, either turn off the television or move quickly past the stupidity. You know, it's like the old days when you used to walk through the airport and you were they were.
You're
left.
Always walking through the airport.
I know. Well, I am.
He second. Is.
Well, no, it's you
true.
Know when they used to solicit.
That must be so rotten.
They used to solicit you. You know, people would solicit you when you walk through the airport before it used to be before, and now you can't. But and you just learn to ignore the 50 solicitations from whatever, you know, a good or scam groups that we're trying to solicit you, and then you walk to your destination. That's what you basically have to learn to do as a media consumer.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law.
See terms and conditions. 18+. Carpenter versus the United States. This is a big digital privacy case we have talked about before, Emily. It was argued this week at the Supreme Court. Update us. Tell us about it. Why is it important?
Timothy Carpenter is accused of being part of a gang of robbers that committed a string of robberies. And there's a central delicious irony in this case, which was that the robbery at the center of this constitutional challenge was Radio Shack, and they stole a bunch of phones. So they stole a bunch of phones. The cops start investigating. They decide they want the cell phone tower records for Carpenter. They think he's one of the masterminds of this robbery plot, though it wasn't particularly well executed. So mastermind's not really the word, but like, you know, one of the leaders. And they get the records from the cell phone towers, and they show basically everything about Timothy Carpenter's movements over 127 days. It's like almost 13,000 data points about his location. And the police got all this information without a traditional warrant where you have to show probable cause for wanting this information. And then when Carpenter was convicted, this cell phone tower location data was part of the government's evidence against him because it showed that he was very near some of the robbery places around the time they were taking place. There was also evidence against Carpenter from witnesses of the robberies, and some of the people, some of the robbers flipped and turned on him. So he is challenging his conviction on the grounds that the government should have gotten a traditional probable cause warrant. What the government got instead was permission to get these records through what's called the Stored Communications Act. And this is a law that Congress passed that set a lower threshold for getting cell location data or other kinds of digital data. All the prosecutors have to show is that they have a reasonable belief that the records will be relevant to their investigation. So the key question before the Supreme Court is, when you're talking about the kind of data that can track us 24/7, that is essentially surveillance data, does the probable cause standard from the Constitution apply? This is the standard in the Fourth Amendment that determines whether something is a reasonable or unreasonable search. Or did Congress step in and by setting this lower standard, essentially, like, you know, replace the Fourth Amendment? And was that a considered judgment that Congress should be able to make? And then, of course, like the backdrop for this case is in a world in which there is the potential for the government to know so much about us from our digital breadcrumb trail we're leaving behind. Do we need to, like, make sure that this probable cause standard is all the more adhered to in light of the potential privacy violations? And the 1970s cases that the Supreme Court decided where they gave prosecutors access without showing probable cause to all the numbers you dial on your landline, like, does that even apply anymore? The justification for that standard was that those are business records, so they were, like, from a third party. It's not the same as asking you to turn over your own data because you've consented to make this record with the phone company. And so the Supreme Court this week, most of the justices were wrestling with the relevance of that precedent.
All right, I have a couple of questions. Number one, when they got the records, did they get it off the phone or did they get it from the phone company?
From the phone companies.
Okay.
If they had gotten it from the phone, it would have been illegal. They would have had to show probable cause. We already have a decision from 2014 finding that.
And it does seem that the justices are fully aware that the nature of the modern phone is very different from any object that's existed before in the sense that it is ubiquitous. It is constantly gathering and collecting and disseminating data, and it is a necessary condition of modern life, right? They seem aware of all of those facts.
Yeah, and basically 7 of the 9 of them were skeptical of the government's position here. I mean, that doesn't mean it'll be a 7-2 decision, but there were 7 justices, really everyone except for Alito and Kennedy seemed worried about the, like, big brother aspect of this.
What the distinction that I kind of came to, and I don't know whether this has been discussed, Emily, is that it seems like if you do something that you are doing actively with your phone. If it is an affirmative thing, that an action you take, if you make a phone call at a particular place at a particular time, and you that phone call pings a cell tower where you've done it, or you've uploaded a photo at that moment of a at a place at a time, that's a record that the government should have access to. The thing that concerns me is the idea that all of the times when you aren't doing anything, but where your phone is still in communication, is checking in, where it's passive, like where the phone is doing things passively, that stuff seems should not be gettable.
Why do you feel like that's the key distinction?
Because if you are actively doing something, if you've chosen, I'm out here, I'm about to rob this cell phone store, and I'm making a call to my collaborators. When you make that phone call, I feel like you are creating a record that isn't that's an action where you're using. Yes, it's a tool that you have to carry with you all the time, but it's the fact that you have chosen to make a call at that location reveals you, and so that ought to be a record. My understanding was that these guys are tracking that what they're collecting is not simply when you make a phone call, but also it's just where you are all the time, because your phone is constantly sort of checking in off towers, right?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I guess so. The way this arises in this case most directly is that the law that's developed around the Fourth Amendment is based on what's called your reasonable expectation of privacy, mostly. It's like, does the normal person walking around expect this to be something that's closely held, that the government can't get without probable cause? That's not the whole test, but it's essentially most of it at this point. And so there was this conversation. It's like, well, do people know that they're being their movements are being tracked all the time, or do they not know? And I guess the wrinkle you're adding is like, maybe. Well, I think people do know when they upload a photo or make a call that is going to be recorded. And so it's on them to shield their movements if they want to. Kennedy seemed to think that all of us know all the time that we're walking around with these little tracking devices. He didn't seem to think there was a reasonable expectation of privacy. He made this little joke like, well, I know that, so everyone must know that. I find this whole line of thinking to be kind of odd. Like, right. I don't really care. First of all, like, who knows what most people know about how their phones work? I don't care. I just care about whether we think it's a good idea or not. And the fundamental thing to me about this case that to me makes it an easy case is it is not that hard for prosecutors to show probable cause and to get warrants. When prosecutors ask for search warrants, they almost always receive them from the judge. This is not like some big bar. It sounds to me like there was plenty of evidence against Timothy Carpenter. Like, for sure they would have gotten a warrant. Right. And given the potential for this, like, enormous amount of surveillance, which seems like it's limitless, why wouldn't we stick to this standard? Like, this seems to be one moment in which the framers got it right. And the law as it developed, absent these questions about technology, is only more relevant now. So I just don't understand why it is such a big deal to just be like, you know what, let's have probable cause.
But why isn't that? I'm sorry, not to make it all about me. Why isn't my passive-active distinction the real distinction?
It could be if you think that's the most important thing, but again, I'm not convinced, because you think that like people know when they're doing something.
Well, I don't.
Active,
I agree with you that it's not that knowledge question is not actually that important. We all know that we're being tracked all the time. That doesn't
I'm
mean
not
that,
sure we do, but who cares?
But that doesn't. Anyway. That shouldn't be the standard of whether the government can look at every bit of information about you. I think to me the standard is: have you done something in the world? Like, have you revealed yourself to the world at that moment? When you're just simply walking around doing your business and you happen to be carrying a phone with you, that to me is not you are a totally private person at that moment. No one should know anything about you. You should be able to go anywhere and do anything. And the phone is something you have to carry as a matter of utility. It's like a heartbeat at this point. But when you actively use the object to convey information, to convey something, to check in on the world, that seems to me like, okay, I am now revealing myself to the world, and that's a fact that ought to be knowable. The kind of passive information that you're giving off, or that is being collected about you, seems to me should never be known.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you're reasoning as like the innocent person who has nothing to hide. But I feel like what I care about is, what does the government have to do to get that everything I did for the last 127 days?
No, I agree. Yes, no, like, I totally agree with the warrant. No, I agree with you about the warrant. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I agree.
Wait, but are you saying it should be off limit no matter what? the passive collection
should be off limits no matter what.
But so take that out of the technology. So if your passive activity not related to the crime is captured on a CCTV, should that be inadmissible? Under the same rules.
Well, I think, okay, so if you pass a person on the street.
Like, right, and they see you.
They see you.
They can identify where you were. Right?
This came up in argument, like, is the camera just a witness? Is the cell phone tower just a witness? The government's lawyer made that argument that essentially the cell phone tower is like a should be treated as a witness. And of course we don't ask, like, is there probable cause before we question witnesses? I find that to be horrifying because it treats, like, you know, the automated potential of surveillance as the same as human observation.
Right. And the fact is that in a modern society, by that standard, then we are every one of us is constantly witnessed every second that's totally unreasonable. The government should get to know that. I think that the security camera one is an interesting case because it does require effort, at least at this point, to track down who are you, was that you there?
Right.
And so I think that the camera can count as a witness in a way your own phone, which you own, which they know you own, shouldn't count.
Is there any way
your own phone doesn't count? It's right. We know that
because of cell phone.
Well, but it's your phone. But it's your phone talking to your own phone, revealing you. Your own phone exposing you.
Yes. And are you, I mean, the way the court was conceptualizing this in line with their past cases, are you helping to create these records? Chief Justice Roberts said that. If you're making the record with the phone company, is it really just a third party piece of information?
And because you've engaged in the contract with the phone company, you're making it with the phone company.
Right. That was the comeback. I can't remember if it was Alito or someone was like, well, you're voluntarily walking around with this phone, which I find that also to be such an artificial and wooden notion of how we all use our phones. Like, we don't have very much of a choice.
Well,
you could turn it off all the time.
Yeah. Or turn off turn off cellular data or turn off something. But maybe it's still pinging for all the fuck I know. Maybe it's still pinging.
It's always pinging.
Some of
it's
your apps ask you permission, but some of them I think don't. I think they just run in the background.
No means no, Emily. No means no.
I feel like I turn it off. Never mind.
Emily, you can get one last word. Is this, who's going to win? Is this digital privacy triumph?
I think yes. I think the court, you know, there's the case we've been talking about, Riley versus California, that is in the direction of caution in terms of opening us up to all this eavesdropping. And then there's the GPS case from a couple of years earlier where the government wasn't allowed to put, I think, a 30-day GPS on a car that was going to track all the time. One weird thing that happened at oral argument was Neil Gorsuch had some idea this was about property rights, which seemed sort of like a strange conceptualization, but I guess it'll be interesting to see what he writes. I think that the government is going to lose to some degree. There is an interesting question about Congress stepping in. I'm interested in that. Like the idea that it could Congress essentially override this part of the Fourth Amendment. I mean, that's not really how it's supposed to work because the Constitution is the fundamental document. I don't really like that idea. So actually, the more I think about it, the more I think that the court should rein in the government here.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Let us go to cocktail chatter. When you're sitting around the fire in New Haven, Emily, with a snifter, a goblet, a stein, what will you be chattering about?
I don't know if I know what a stein. Oh, I guess yes, I can kind of visualize a stein. John's like, please. So I'm going to do a double chatter. The first thing I want to chatter about is if, like me, you are thinking a lot about sexual harassment and where we are and how far we have and have not come, I recommend an interview that Rebecca Traister did on Ezra Klein's show this week. She just did an excellent job of talking about the history and giving context. And there's a lot of she's thinking out loud in a way that I thought was like very evocative and resonant for me. And I wanted also to recommend a new book that's coming out in January, but you can order it on Amazon now. It's called Green. It's a novel. It's by Sam Graham Felsen. I think it's his first book. And it's about a kid, a white kid at an almost all black school in Jamaica Plains in the 80s, I think. And like what it's like to be that kid and looking at these questions of race and identity through that lens. And it's really stuck with me. It has like some lovely rollicking language and passages in it. And the main character is a 12-year-old, which is a really good age to write from. And it has a kind of honesty about it, I thought, that was really appealing. So Green by Sam Graham Felsen. I'm sure you'll hear more about in January, but you can get a jump on it by going to buy it now.
JD, what is your chatter?
My chatter is some self-log rolling, kind of. I feel like I don't do that
much.
Oh,
no, we never do that here.
Well, I feel like I haven't used this chit in a while, but not since the Face the Nation diary, which is ages ago. Anyway, we did a book. Almost the entire show was about books on Face the Nation this last week. There were two segments. One was with Robert Dalek, Ron Chernow, Nancy Kane, and Mark Updegrove about leaders in crisis, presidents. So I recommend the conversation to you, but also all of those books are good. So since we're all authors here, I'm always happy to be promoting good authors and good conversation. And it was a nice step out of our current moment. And then I talked to Walter Isaacson about Leonardo da Vinci, which was also a conversation I enjoyed. So if you like books, those topics, I recommend that and those authors to you.
I listened to your Walter conversation. It was really interesting. So I double commend it. My chatter is I've got four chatters. I have four.
So much chatter.
But they're all
like,
really, they're all super short.
Like teeth on a cold day.
Because Thanksgiving weekend is this time when if you're like me, you haven't seen movies forever. You get to catch up on culture, or you get to do things you haven't done. So I saw two movies and read one book. And also then I have a log rolling. So but the two movies I saw, which I would recommend highly to everybody, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Frances McDormand, amazing, strange, brilliant movie about a woman who has lost her daughter to a terrible crime and the small town in which she is sort of raising a ruckus about that. Incredible movie. Woody Harrelson just is mesmerizingly great in that. And second movie, Wonder, based on I can't remember the author's name, but the book of the same name, Wonder.
R.J. Palacio.
R.J. Palacio. Movie.
That's her pen name.
Movie is just so moving. I've never cried as much in a movie. It's beautiful. And Julia Roberts puts everybody else, all other actors in America to shame. She's the most winning person probably on the planet as an actress.
Oh my God, I'm so depressed that that's your conception of actressdom, that Julia Roberts is your favorite person.
She's not the greatest actress. She is a person who conveys charm and warmth and empathy. She's amazing. There's a certain kind of role, like the America's Sweetheart role. No one people have come for that role. She remains the queen. She's just like pushed them down the hill,
as all American sweethearts do.
Sandra Bullock is like lying in a heap at the bottom. I'm not saying she's the best actress in the world. I don't think that's true. I think, but there's a certain kind of embodiment of warmth that she is just amazing at. And that movie is great. And then a book, Version Control by Dexter Palmer. I don't know why no one has talked about this book. This book is like if Jonathan Franzen wrote sci-fi, and it's an amazing book. It's set in the sort of a near future where someone is trying to develop a time machine, and there's all kinds of other strange things that are happening in the world. And it's just a portrait of a half a dozen people in this world. And it's a brilliant book. So Version Control by Dexter Palmer, if you like slightly dystopic sci-fi and also like Jonathan Franzen.
I'm looking at it on the situation.
Sounds like the best Hanukkah present.
It's a great Hanukkah present. Actually, no. You know what the best Hanukkah present is? My fourth one. the Atlas Obscura book.
Oh, Why, it's a log roll.
It's a log roll. It is the best gift.
You're leading up to it.
For the joyful nerds in your life, Atlas Obscura, the Atlas Obscura book, it is an, you know, it was much gifted last year by many people, but if you didn't get a chance to gift it, it is a book that everybody loves, 8 to 88. It is just filled with wonder and beauty, and people will leaf through it and they will adore it. So get the Atlas Obscura book. And that is our show for today, our log rolly show for today. Emily didn't log roll anything. Emily has nothing to sell.
Do I have like a credit?
Would you like to log roll something, Emily?
No, I really don't.
You're Yale class, you need signups.
That's not my job. No. Okay.
All right. New York people should buy New York Times Magazine subscriptions, but they can't get the New York Times.
They can buy New York Times subscriptions, but I am not log rolling for my employer. No.
All right.
People should make their own choices about what they buy.
That is our show for today. The Political Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank, who also never log rolls. Our researcher is Izzy Rode, if you have something to log roll, Izzy, let us know. We'll log roll for it next week. You should subscribe to the Gabfest on Apple Podcasts or anywhere where you listen. Please subscribe. It really helps us when you subscribe and also when you rate us and review us. So do that. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. And for some of you, we'll see you in Boston at our live show in the Wilbur Theater next Wednesday. Tickets at slate.com/live.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.